This is Public Sector Voices with Emily Rogers. Today we're joined by Councillor Mandy Clare from Cheshire West and Chester Council. Councillor Clare is calling for the full Cabinet to declare a poverty and inequality emergency and has also been appointed as champion for poverty and inequality by the Council leader. So it's a really interesting topic why you're on today. I mean, we've seen the majority of councils in England now declaring climate emergencies, but this is a completely different one. I've never heard of a poverty emergency before. Is this something that you came up with?
Yep, we're going first with this one. It kind of it builds on some work that we've already done around the Poverty Truth Commission. So we ran two of those as a council, and I think we were the first or one of the first councils in the country to actually set those up as a council-run thing. And they're very much rooted within the community, so they take their lead from community members who've got lived experience of living in poverty. But it was something, the poverty emergency, because I was appointed as the poverty leader's champion for poverty and inequality shortly after I became a councillor last year.
Yeah.
The intention really was to declare one at that point anyway, because we'd seen this huge rise in food bank usage. We know that cost of living has increased and that benefits, and the benefits also that support people that are in low paid work, haven't increased, have even been capped. So we've kind of seen this increase in people at the forefront of destitution in their family life, even prior to COVID. So it was something that I wanted to pursue prior to COVID. I had discussed it with the leader of the council. Other things kind of took over. And then obviously we had the COVID pandemic and the lockdown. So what that's done really is sharpened our awareness. It's a strange thing to say, but it might be one positive thing that's come out of the pandemic, is that it has actually sharpened our awareness around the extent to which people are actually surviving in poverty at the moment.
And would it be fair to say that it's also kind of made those issues more severe as well?
COVID definitely has. Yes, it has. And we haven't even seen, that play out fully yet. Mm-hmm. So all of the forecasts that we're getting from the OBR and elsewhere, our local enterprise partnership, right across the board, are predicting that, we're looking at least 10% of those that are on furlough currently permanently losing their jobs. And then the hidden aspect of unemployment is the number of hours that have been cut from people that are already on insecure contracts. So there's a lot of hidden aspects to this, and it's going to take time for the full data to come through. But daily, we're seeing large companies that are having to lay off hundreds or thousands of workers. And that's to be expected, because we've all seen the impact that that's had on, people's willingness to shop on the high streets, and the impact that social distancing has on businesses and how many people that they can have, within their premises and that kind of thing. So it's obvious what's happening. We don't know the extent to which it's going to unfold yet. There's a lot of uncertainty, but certainly we know that there's been a disproportionate impact, not just in terms of job losses and hours cuts, but also health impacts and educational impacts on people that are already struggling on low income. But then on top of that, you've got people who've been doing okay prior to COVID who've now been tipped into poverty as a result of COVID. So yeah, we kind of know what's coming, we just don't know the extent of it yet.
And is this something that just needs to go through your council cabinet, or will it need to be run by central government as well?
It won't need to be run by central government, but it will need to go through full council. So the stage that we're at now is, I made an initial approach to the cabinet a couple of months ago and made the suggestion and laid out what some of the commitments would be, the vision really for us to try and not just adopt this within our council, but to get other councils to jump on board with this in the way that has happened with the climate emergency. And if we try and make it fairly uniform, obviously every council area is different, and they will have a different makeup, within their community that they have to respond to. But if we're collecting, say, broadly similar data sets, and we're trying to improve our insights into the effects of COVID on people on low incomes, and the creation of new people within a low income situation as a result of COVID, then it means that we've got more of a unified voice that we can then use to share good practice and reprioritize locally where that's possible. And then where there's an unmet need, that we've identified and we've evidenced and other councils have evidenced that we can then make the case to national government, because a lot of this is hidden and it is going to take a bit more of an effort really to unpick the whole picture. So that went, that suggestion went to Cabinet. They asked me to come back with a paper, a formal paper setting it out, which I had support with putting that together from the officers, because I haven't done that before as a new councillor. And then at the next cabinet meeting, the leader of the council spoke to the paper and I spoke to it as well. And then it was, you know, it was cross-party involvement in discussion and debate, and it received unanimous support from the cabinet to recommend this to full council at our next full council meeting. So that's kind of the process, a bit of a long-winded process, but, you know, it's important.
Progress is being made.
Yeah, and it's not, we're not going to wait. Obviously, the issues that are impacting people in terms of COVID and poverty, they're unfolding daily, so they're not going to wait for that. So in the meantime, I've had the go-ahead from Cabinet to set up this board alongside one of our community inspirers, multi-agency board, where we can actually get, you know, get a bit of a head start on some of this work.
And what has been the reaction of other councils? Have you had any kind of indication that they're going to follow suit, or...?
Yeah, we have had some inquiries. I'm in the process at the moment of putting together an information pack, and it's nearly there. I've done a couple of sort of radio interviews. The press have covered it, so I'm just gathering together the links. I've done a little video which talks about it as well. And I'm just waiting on, we need a covering letter from the leader of the council. And I've put in the final statistics, the most up-to-date ones that we've got in there. And then when that's ready to go, we'll be able to encourage, send those packs out to people that are interested. So anyone who is interested needs to get in touch with me. And then I've got you on, I'll have you on a list, and I'll be able to send the information out when we've got it all together, which should be soon.
Yeah, and I suppose that would be the other benefit of if central government were to get involved, it would kind of shine a light on it a bit more.
I mean, that would be great. It really would. And it's not as if, you know, there isn't enough evidence, because there is plenty. But we need to kind of dig deeper as well. We need to make a commitment to dig deeper and to make sure that we make the extra effort to paint as full a picture as possible. Because with something like poverty, there's a lot of shame, there's a lot of stigma. And people can be very slow to come forward. I mean, I think there can be a perception that people are looking for, you know, a free lunch, if you want to put it that way, or to avoid working or whatever. But the evidence doesn't back that up. But on the contrary, the stories that we hear and the accounts that we hear of people who have really struggled to situate up to the point where they really can't manage. And we've even had people, you know, we've heard of people who've been hospitalised because they've been desperately short of food, and we can't let that happen within a country as wealthy as the one that we live in.
Yeah,
we can't let that happen. And when we're looking at our priorities post COVID, we have to make sure that this is on the top of that list in terms of how we're reprioritizing our resources. So if central government were to support this, that would be fantastic. It really would. Yeah,
this is one of the things that was, I found really interesting about your video, because I watched it before we did this podcast. And yeah, when you were talking about the shame and the stigma that people feel, even children, I mean, and the idea that children being in poverty is their fault, like, yes, to a rational person is preposterous. But I do know what you mean, that, yes, you know, they might not want to talk about it at school because their friends are all talking about the new things that they have.
Yeah, that's the way it happens. I mean, I've heard of one child where they were on pupil premium, and that's the funding that comes into the school when a child is on preschool meals. And that could be, you know, the parent might be working, but just on a very low income. Or, you know, they might need the safety net for other reasons, disability or whatever. And this child, the register was beamed up onto the board so the whole classroom could see it. And this child had a P, letter P next to their name. And the other children were asking them, why have you got a letter P next to your name and we haven't? And the thing is that nobody has done that on purpose to stigmatise that child. But
no,
there's lots of different ways that kids can end up feeling stigmatised or awkward or ashamed, that, you know, they're not necessarily done intentionally, but we talk about all sorts of things. We'll talk about, you know, weight issues, eating disorders, you know, gender. We can talk about sex, drugs. We can talk about everything in schools now, but we don't talk about poverty and the stigma and shame associated with it. And that means that there's a large proportion of kids within schools that are carrying this stress, you know, and the more that we can talk about it. One of the things that happened through the Poverty Truth Commission was that young people living in a low-income area wrote a script and filmed and directed their own film, which told the story of a child who was hiding their, you know, their experience of poverty from their friends, from the teachers, and from their own family. That's quite powerful, you know, when you think of that. So the idea is to use that within training, but so that other children can see that they're not on their own in that situation. And breaks down some of that stigma and barrier, but also so that teachers and some of our teams can also, and our counsellors as well, who might not have lived in poverty, can better understand how that feels.
Yeah, so that's the kind of thing that the declaration will kind of achieve, to be able to shine a light on things like that and reduce the stigma. And what other things do you hope will come from being able to just declare it in council by council?
Well, as I said, we've already begun some amazing work, working with members within the community who've got lived experience of poverty, and we've brought that together, that experience together with the professional side of things, so the delivery of services side of things within the council, and enabled those conversations to take place within an honest environment. And through that, people who are affected by poverty have been able to recognise the barriers they have, you know, their perceptions of the council or whatever. But equally, people who work within the council have been able to address some of the assumptions that they may have had, or some of the barriers that they have had up when they're dealing with people who are accessing services. And through that, we've been able to actually, one area where we had a big impact was around reducing evictions.
Yeah.
They reduced by, I think it was up to 70%, and it also delivered over 100,000 in cost savings to the council just through tweaking policy. So it can be very powerful just to enable these conversations at that kind of interface between the lived experience and the professional experience. So that's one thing. Obviously the training, which I've mentioned, and the awareness raising, destigmatizing. I want it to be a very data-driven and evidence-based approach. So it's not so much a political or party political issue, but it's about looking at what evidence we have in front of us and responding to that, albeit in a non-stigmatizing way, because stigma doesn't help anyone, you know.
No.
And there's lots of reasons why someone might be in poverty, and we can't make those assumptions. It's not helpful to. It's just a case of looking at what the situation is and what we can do about it. I've made contact with local universities. Some research is already underway in its early stages into the extent of hunger and the impact of COVID on that from the university point of view. And I've also spoken to our own research and intelligence officer to see what we've already got, and to just share some of the ideas that I've got around what we need to collect in order to have a better picture of what's happened and why, you know, how it ends up that we've got a disproportionate number of people from low-income communities dying.
Yeah.
You know, or developing long-term health impacts from COVID, and all of the wider things to do with accessing education and educational attainment that are likely to show up in the evidence as we move along, so that we can track it. So we want to try and use that. We want to join together with other authorities. I want to broaden our partnership so that we include the unions, so that we've got a finger on the pulse, particularly with regards to issues that are faced by people that are in insecure work and low status work.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, I think what we've managed to do, what we've managed to establish from COVID, is that we all do need each other, you know, and we need to maybe re-evaluate how the value that we place on certain types of work. You know, some of the most essential workers have been the ones on low income, low levels of income security from their job, insecure contracts, low status, regarded as low skills, and they've held everything together for the rest of us, in some cases at the cost of their lives. And so that has to be borne in mind in how we reprioritize and how we reshape our society going forward. And council by council, you can do a certain amount, but joined together, perhaps we can achieve more on that. So.
Yeah, in a way, this might be the ideal time to kind of bring in this new notion, because people are making that realisation now after what we've been through.
Definitely. Yeah, definitely. The world's changed, hasn't it? It's never going to be what it was, you know. And in a lot of ways, it's changed in, you know, very shocking, negative ways. But there are there are valuable lessons that we can learn from this if we've got the will to. So,
yeah, and what about going back to what you're saying about evidence? How are you using data, or how is data helping to kind of identify the people who need this kind of support and give you more of a rounded picture of what that is?
So in our borough at the moment, we know that food bank was, reliance has more than doubled during lockdown. At one point, it was really a lot higher than double. Mm-hmm. And we know that in terms of universal credit claimants, at one point that was quadrupled, I think, during the lockdown period, and it's around about double. And we're looking obviously at the national trends in terms of likely redundancies and job losses. I don't know. It's just kind of looking at the whole overall picture at the moment in terms of the stats and the data that we currently have. But we need to dig deeper into that. So we know, for instance, at the moment that families on middle and higher incomes have been able to be a lot more active in terms of homeschooling. And they've had a lot more support as well, a lot more interaction and support from school. So perhaps they've been more proactive or been able to be more proactive in seeking that support. So just if you take the case of education, we don't have the data at the moment to tell us, you know, enough detail as to what's happened there or why. So we could dig deeper and we could try and do some more consultation with families that are on low incomes as to, are they online, you know? Do they have the physical space or quiet space for the children to learn? If we head into another lockdown, how can we manage that better, and how can we try and ensure that we've got a share of support available to the families that are furthest away from being able to access it to try and balance things out? So it's just trying to be more sensitive, really, to what families' situations are. And you can't always just look at who's on a vulnerable list, an official vulnerable list, because, you know, as with the list of people who had health vulnerabilities from the government, we knew that there were quite a number of people who also had vulnerabilities as a result of health that didn't qualify to appear on that list, and we've had to kind of pick up the difference. So if we quantify that, we have a look at what funding we've received, we have a look at what the need's actually been in its truest sense through making sure that we've done that research, then it puts us in a better position to argue, you know, for additional resources if that's what seems to be needed.
Yeah, and I'd assume, I don't know if it's wrongly or rightly, that this kind of declaration would aim to kind of get more funding into those communities or those areas. But is it more to do with kind of breaking that cycle of being like on the poverty line or above it or below it, and instead of just kind of plugging any gaps, it's more of like a social change?
It's that as well, actually, because we are starting to see some green shoots of community activism within low income areas, you know. So I think that having the community inspirers on board, and also the natural sort of outpouring of support from within low income communities. We've had volunteers, and we've still got volunteers who are delivering packages to people who can't go to the shops or they're worried about going to the shops. And we've got, you know, an increased number of volunteers helping out with food banks to help to cope with the additional demand. And we're seeing community groceries being set up, where it helps in terms of environmental outcomes because it reduces food waste. It helps the supermarkets because they'd have to pay to get rid of that food waste. And it also helps people who are on a low income, because you can get, you know, a decent range of food for a fraction of the cost that you'd normally have to pay in the supermarket. But none of that is a long-term solution to poverty. You know, a long-term solution needs to be, if somebody is in need of the safety net provides them with enough money to be able to go in the shop and choose their food the same as anybody else would, because it's just a basic human dignity as well as a health issue. And the same with people that are working, you know, if they're on a low income, they shouldn't have to do that. It's nice to be able to do that. It's nice to do your bit for the environment, but it shouldn't be a requirement in order to live and feed your family. And so what would be really good would be if we could support communities in looking at these issues holistically and campaigning themselves, you know, for the change that they feel is needed, if they feel that change is needed. There's a massive underrepresentation of low-income people within local government as councillors and within political parties, all political parties nationally. And it's something that we don't really talk about, but it obviously has an impact on policy, on what gets prioritised. And with something as hidden and stigmatised as poverty, it can only help if we look at, you know, if we reassess and we start to do some proper, some more serious measurement of that extent of political underrepresentation of people from low-income backgrounds. It can only help us to be more democratic and more representative of those issues, I think. So it's about a whole community approach. It's about social justice. It's about social action. It's about encouraging the grassroots to have a voice with regards to their own issues. Myself, you know, I've experienced being on a low income. I was became a mum when I was 16. My trajectory has been a bit different from most people in that circumstance because I'd managed to get myself a certain level of education together. And I was able to go to university with my little one. And it's been a massive struggle from that, you know, even with the advantages that I've had. So people who don't have those advantages have got an even more of an uphill, you know, struggle. But I think what it does is if you've had that experience of poverty, it makes you passionate about those issues and you never ever forget what that feels like and all of the different impacts on it. So we need more people who can be vocal about these issues within positions of influence.
Yeah, and I think that will come when the stigma is removed as well.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. So the other thing is we do need to be honest about poverty. So the Poverty Truth Commission is just that. It's about telling the truth about poverty, and that's what's at the in the foundations, really, of this work that we're doing with the poverty emergency. So if we're finding that there is a lack of, you know, sufficient jobs within the jobs market that people can actually afford to live a dignified and healthy existence on, we need to tell the truth about that as well. You know, that's part of destigmatizing, is saying, hang on, there's a whole system at play here. It's not necessarily about individual fault. But you can't say that just from a political point of view. You have to look at the evidence. Yeah.
And I suppose geography will make a big difference as well, because there will be some councils in England who genuinely won't feel the need to declare a poverty emergency, and there will be some areas in England who desperately need to declare it. So how's that going to work?
Well, if we take our case, Cheshire West and Chester, I mean, in some ways you might think that we wouldn't be an obvious borough to start with this, because we've got 14.9% of our children in poverty, but the national average is 18.6%. But then we've got wards within our borough where that level of poverty, of children in poverty, is as high as 48%, you know, and it's not just one ward, there's a few of them. So in any borough, I can't think of any borough where there aren't going to be some wards or some sub-areas of wards where you have really high levels of poverty. So I don't think there'd be very many that it wouldn't be relevant to. But it's interesting. But if you just look at the county average, then it might appear that way. I don't know. Yeah,
because my initial thoughts were that area doesn't strike me as a place that has, you know, a lot of poverty, but yeah, it shows how wrong it can be.
Well, it's really interesting because there's a lot of research as well which shows that children who are in, say you've got a child that's in a school where that child's living in a low-income household, but they go to a school where all of their friends are quite affluent, their trajectory in terms of their academic attainment is actually, it's harmed to a greater extent than if they were in a school amongst their peers in similar circumstances. So that, again, comes back to, you know, this point about stigma, about shame, about the self-blame, and also children just feeling inadequate. It can have a huge impact on their attainment, that in itself, you know, as well as on top of being able to access the books or access private tutoring or whatever to, you know, plug any gaps in their you know, their educational ability. So it's such a complex picture, and children who are poor living in richer areas often fare worse as a result of living in a richer area. So it is, yes, it's quite, when we start
That's
digging
really
into it, it's quite an interesting area. Yeah.
And will this move look to kind of support the homeless communities, or is it more just people who have low income?
I think it has to incorporate everybody that's affected. So one of the questions that came up from one of the Conservative councillors when I took this to Cabinet was a really good question, and that was around rural poverty. I think we have to cast the net wide. We've just got to look at anyone who's affected. We've got some really good work in the offing with our Police and Crime Commissioner, David Keane. He is looking to invest, if I get this right, hope that I get this right, but the proceeds of criminal activity that have been seized, he's looking to reinvest those within the community around youth work provision, which we know has made a huge impact on communities, but that some of that's disappeared. And then also rehabilitation of people with addictions, substance and alcohol misuse. So rather than looking at good and bad people, it's looking at, okay, we know evidence tells us that there's usually an adverse childhood event which has preceded criminal activity in relation to substance abuse. So let's have a look at the adverse childhood event, see if we can try and get some help and support in place for that. And that in turn might help to reduce the abuse and the substance abuse and the crime. So it's a nice innovative way of looking at things. And it also dovetails with this poverty emergency approach. They can both kind of gel together and have a synergy there for the community as a whole. So yeah, it's looking at homelessness, looking at rural poverty, looking at in-work poverty, looking at long-term poverty, looking at people who've been newly tipped into poverty as a result of COVID, right across the board, everything.
That notion that you were just talking about seems much more kind of progressive than what we're used to, what we have been used to.
Definitely, yeah. Yeah, it's I think we have to think about these things intelligently if we want to try and find innovative ways forward. And that's one of the sort of principles at the heart of the poverty emergency approach, is that we want to take an innovative look at this. We don't want to do what's always been done. Although having said that, I think we've made a good start with the Poverty Truth Commission.
Yeah, and I really hope that by doing this podcast and all the other things that you're doing, a lot more people will get on board with you, because I do think it's really important. So I really hope it goes well. Thank you so much for joining us today.
That's brilliant. Thank you so much for having me on the show. Thank you.
Join us next week, where we'll be speaking to Martina Kane from the Health Foundation, talking about how the prospects of young people directly affects their health.